Hello and welcome to a Kulturico podcast. I'm your host, Alexander Brown. We're in Hyde Park, London. A beautiful swan is gliding past. And we're going to talk about Syrian civil war, but also the past, present, and future of Syria. And to do that, I'm delighted to be joined today by Iyad Youssef, a Syrian scholar who specializes in economics and politics. Welcome, Iyad, to the Kulturico podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
No problem.
So
I thought I'd start just by asking you about your background. Yeah. And as I was saying, your past and your present and your studies.
So I was born and raised in Syria until 2014. I decided to leave the country, or like late 2013, I decided to leave the country. And I initially left to the US where I started learning English. And during that time, I applied for a master's degree in conflict studies at Brandeis University. It was challenging because of my ability or command of the English language. Initially, I didn't manage to pass the TOEFL test during the university-administrated TOEFL test, which is supposed to be easier than the regular TOEFL test. So the first master's degree was challenging. I had no idea about writing academic articles. I had issues with speaking. I was shy and embarrassed to share my thoughts in lectures. And during that time, I got exposed to the writing of Professor Paul Collier. He's an economist and he's working on conflicts in Africa. And I like the idea of combining economics with conflicts. And then that where I decided to apply for my second master at Oxford, where Professor Paul teaches at the Blavatsky School of Government. And that is where I also met the Professor Jonathan Wolf. He's a professor of philosophy, and also I fall in love with philosophy. And
quite right.
Yes. So like it's fascinating how you kind of look at different issues, contemporary issues from true perspective, from the perspective of positivism, how to design the right approach or the inputs needed to solve an issue, but also from ethical point of view, what ought to be done to solve this issue. So they are two complementary kind of disciplines. So that's why I was interested in philosophy along with economics. It was interdisciplinary studies program and
what in Oxford?
In Oxford, mm-hmm. Yes. So we covered finance, economics, philosophy, politics, law. But I felt like I still need to kind of improve my understanding of economics because I'm passionate about economics. So that is where I decided to pursue my third master, MPhil, in economics at Sawas University. I wanted to gain the quantitative skills to be able to launch my own research focusing on Syria. That is in the nutshell.
Very nice. I guess I wanted to ask you, moving on from your last point, so you're obviously passionate about philosophy and politics in Syria. How is it that economics really how do you feel like this is the topic that can really be applied to the issues you want to address in Syria today?
So you can use economics to think about the root causes of the civil war and also use it as a tool for the reconstruction process following signing any potential peace agreement. So when you look at the root causes of the civil war, there are several indicators that could signify the possibility of the outbreak of the civil war, including the high unemployment rate among the youth in Syria, needs for economic reforms. Everything is centralized by the government. We don't have open market economy. The government has to provide all the jobs for newly graduate youth students. It's unable. We don't have open economy, so the private sector cannot provide jobs. So economy can help to understand the root causes of the Syrian civil war, but also at the same time, when you look at the reconstruction, you can see what is required to have an economy that would offer jobs for these people who have been left out because of the war. They are in need to improve their living condition.
So it's simultaneously sort of understanding the issues, but also offering solutions at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, now my future goal is through my master at SOAS, where I can focus on mainly I'm passionate about the macro economic reforms required to bring like foreign investment that would complement the labor market and the internal investment rather than kind of push out the low kind of internal capital out of market. So how they kind of complement to provide jobs and improve the well-being of Syrians.
I wanted to ask you, even these are all solutions to issues in Syria that you feel very strongly. I wanted to go back to something you did before, actually, when you were working at the humanitarian aid organization in Syria, before you did any of these masters. And then this was associated with the Greek Orthodox Church. And I wanted to ask you, how did you find working there, and what were some of the issues that you discovered while you were working there that led you to want to move abroad, but also that led you to realize, okay, there are some issues that you want to resolve in Syria.
Yeah, usually in conflict or war torn countries, usually you need humanitarian intervention, and the dynamic is fast-paced and challenging. So humanitarian intervention is sometimes is difficult or is not as planned as development intervention. And also because the it's fast-paced, everything is changing quickly. And also in Syria itself, we weren't prepared for humanitarian intervention, at least in the local context. Our local organization, they have never experienced something similar. So they don't have the capacity or the knowledge to deal with the influxes of displaced families from one region to another. And also at the same time, working with in war-torn countries, you are also required to bribe, for example, checkpoints to access besieged locations. You need to bribe officials. So I had issues, fundamental issues with these practices. And actually, this is what the topic I focused on during my master at Oxford, when I wrote my final paper in philosophy on whether it's morally justified to bribe checkpoints or not. And apparently my professor liked it and received distinction on my paper, because it was kind of something that always stuck in my head, whether I should have bribed them or not when I reflect on the situation. So I end up writing my final assignment on this. And these are the reason why I felt like I need kind of to move on.
What was your conclusion, incidentally?
It's like a
complex topic.
Yeah, a complex topic. From like philosophical point of view, I would say not to bribe them, but it's like a long argument and how I kind of prove my point that you shouldn't bribe checkpoints, because you would incentivize them to request bribes from people who cannot afford them, and then they will not let these kind of poor people to support their families who are in besieged area because they cannot bribe checkpoints. So then you are responsible for the outcome of people who are besieged and they need of services of support of their poor family members. So this is my kind of conclusion why bribing checkpoint was problematic.
I just wanted to go on, so we'll go on to some of your articles that you've written that are fascinating and open whole new world to talk about. Just before that, though, I'm going to ask you a more personal question. In terms of the fact that you've been away from Syria for so long and studying, when was the last time you returned to the country?
I haven't returned since I left. So 2014 was the last time, like 9th of January 2014, that was the last day I spent
in Syria.
Yeah.
Separation.
Yes.
So you continue to be fascinated with Syria, clearly.
Yes.
And like with studying it.
Yeah.
And yet you do it
remotely.
Remotely.
Yeah.
How has that been, both emotionally and intellectually? I would actually ask on two levels.
Emotionally, it's difficult. It has been difficult. Mainly, I'm not like psychologist myself, but when you have some sort of trauma or issue that happened in your past, you need to move on and forget about it and know how to deal with it. But in case of Syria, it's a recurring issue that is constantly happening. So it's not easy to be like, to put it in the past and move on. So it's constantly on your conscience. And sometimes I try to distance myself from what's happening. But for example, when I wrote my recent articles published at the Foreign Policy magazine, I started digging about the economic conditions in Syria in 2020, and I realized that 85% of Syrians are under poverty line. And then I started thinking, my family is still there, my relatives still there, so they are suffering. They are under poverty line, which means they are surviving with less than $1 a day. And also you feel like at the same time you're guilty for, here, like I live in London, so I feel guilty for going out, spending good quality time while my friends and my family members still in Syria, and they have to deal with water shortage, lack of electricity, blackout, food shortage. So you constantly feel as if you have some sort of guilt for what you are doing right now, but also you have obligation to contribute and help out in one way or another. But it has been difficult to, because it's personally it has been difficult to move on, and it's not only me. I've discussed the same issue with many Syrians, and they experience the same thing, like the sort of guilt when they spend money on themselves here in London while their family, they are suffering and trying to survive, and there is no mechanism or a way to transfer money to Syria, because now there is a new law that would imprison anyone who receives foreign currency in Syria. It's kind of mentally it's difficult.
So anyone who receives foreign currency goes to prison.
Yes, basically, okay. Because they're trying to protect the Syrian currency from collapsing.
Yes.
So this is one of the approach that the government has recently enacted. So it's even like if you want to transfer it through like legal ways. The central bank will take 30% of the total amount or even more. So they will, you have to exchange the currency under the stated, government stated rate, which is sometimes 50% less than the black market rate. So like your family would receive half of your foreign, like your transfer. So it's also problematic in sense, like, because many Syrians here, they're starting trying to establish their life. They don't make as much money, so they have to save and send it there. But in the same time, the government will take 50% of the transfer. So it's also a big issue.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for that answer. Very in depth. Let's talk about your articles now. So now we can zoom in to your thought as well, and also like the situation in Syria and the future.
Yeah.
I was just thinking which one to start with. It's I could start with any of them, really.
Yeah.
But maybe I was thinking I could start a bit further out.
Yeah.
And then we zoom in on Syria.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with your second article.
Yeah.
It's on the link between tourism and democracy in Tunisia.
Yeah.
And the impact of terrorism on that as well. So obviously this isn't Syria. This is another country quite a fair way away from it.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could elaborate more broadly on the threat to, well, but I guess both the threat and the possibility of nascent, of growing democracy in these areas, and how that relates to Syria as well, because I'm certain you have many thoughts about that, and like how democracy could be developed in these countries, and if maybe it's different to Western countries and their form of democracy. And also, like, if you like a general sort of yeah. idea of why you wrote this article.
Yeah. So basically, Tunisia is the only successful model in the MENA region, the only democratic government and parliament that are democratically elected. So I was interested in this phenomenon. And then after the end of the revolution that ousted Ben Ali, the president, terrorist groups started spreading in Tunisia. And they started targeting for foreigners and touristic places. And tourism or the touristic sector is a labor-intensive sector. And it hires up to 30% of the Tunisians. And when terrorist groups target touristic sector, they kind of prevent or create some sort of threat for foreigners to travel to this country, and where they kind of spend their money, bring exchange, bring foreign currency, improve the reserve, the central bank reserve of foreign currency. So then that would mean job will be lost. And then at the same time, the Tunisian government is suffering of financial constraints because of its post-revolution, and they have many issues to resolve themselves. So the government wasn't able to compensate for these people who are losing their jobs because of these terrorist attacks, because tourists stopped, you know, flowing in the country. And when you have unemployed youth, it's associated with political instability. And that is the threat on democracy through the terrorist attack, because they would impact the tourism sector. People will be losing their jobs. The government is unable to compensate these people who lost their jobs. And then they will be unemployed. They would create some instability in the country and will be back into a turmoil. And for me, I just wanted to focus on the role of EU and the US in supporting the Tunisian government, because it's the only model in the MENA region. Because there is this narrative that we don't want our model to, our democratic model to be modeled after Western. We want our own model. So Tunisia is the only Arab model, or like I would say MENA region model. So I was concerned that we need to preserve this model. So we have kind of way for us to craft similar models along the Tunisian model.
Fantastic. And do you, as in, I guess you've kind of answered it already, but do you look to the Tunisian model mm-hmm. as something that Syria could follow?
The Tunisian model in general, yeah, I would say it can be followed.
Particularly as a post-revolutionary country as well. Probably the best.
I mean, if we are in an ideal situation where the president will step down and you would have newly elected government, I think the Tunisian model is a model that can be followed, because Tunisia is trying to maintain it like balance between the two conflicting camps in the MENA region, between the Qatari-Turkey camp and the Saudi and UAE camp, and Egypt on the other hand. So it the country has been trying to be neutral, not kind of to side with each one of them. So it's a good model where the country, Syria, can distance itself from the regional powers and maintain equal footing from all these kind of conflicting parties. But that also depends on whether the president will step down and have newly elected government. So it's a long shot, but hopefully we will reach that kind of goal, I would say.
Well, and now let's move on to Syria, I suppose. Thank you very much. So the next article I wanted to focus on, and I think it flows relatively nicely, speaking of the influences, foreign influences on countries. So we can talk about the foreign influences on Syria. And you wrote one specific article on the role of the US election in the future of Assad.
Yeah.
Tightly bound, of course, to Iran as well, and their own nuclear deal and the sanctions imposed by Trump.
Basically, before 2000, Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current president, he maintained Iranian influence kind of limited in Syria, because he was afraid of exporting the Islamic revolution to the country, and that would mean like kind of forcing him to step down and then electing or appointing a religious figure similar to Iran.
By the Islamic Revolution, do you mean the Iranian
Islamic Revolution? Iranian Islamic Revolution, like okay. a model yeah, like yeah. after okay. it in Syria. Okay. So he was yep. kind of hesitant to permit Iranian influence to grow in Syria. Mm-hmm. But after 2000, you see like Iranian influence started growing in Syria. There were missions being sent to east part of Syria, Raqqa, Deir ez-Zor, where they started engaging with elders and leaders of tribes, because they are the head figures of these tribes, and they try and kind of to sway them to become part of the Shia sect. Mm-hmm. So they started kind of the grassroots intervention or penetration of the Syrian society or the Syrian country.
But presumably this sect was already, like, there were several followers in Syria.
I mean, the Shia sect in Syria is small, but in the 70s, Alawi, when Hafez al-Assad came to power, yeah. mm-hmm. he was rejected by the Sunni majority, and then mm-hmm. he reached out to I can't remember the first name, but his last name, I think, As-Sadr in Lebanon, his imam, and the imam approved that the Alawi, which is the current sect where the president is coming from, is Assad. Part of Shia, and Shia, they are recognized as a sect of Islam. Yep. So he will be accepted by the Sunni, the majority Sunni, Muslim Sunni. But like they're not similar, but they were recognized as part of Shia. But Shia themselves in Syria, they are like minor, like very small minority.
As they are in most of the Muslim world as well.
Yes, they're like the same in Yemen. Mm-hmm. In Iraq, they're like the majority, mm-hmm. but like in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Saudi mm-hmm. Arabia. So they are minority. But when the war started, Assad was losing large kind of lands, and that when Hezbollah and Iran started sending combatants
in support of Assad,
officers like senior officers to kind of help the regime to strategize and combat the opposition forces. And they, since the beginning of the Syrian civil war, Iran had offered a credit line for the Syrian regime to allow the regime to import Iranian oil on credit, and also import essential goods from Iran. And the figures of how much Iran has lent the Syrian regime, it varies, it depends on the source, but it could go up to $50 billion, which is a huge amount. And comparing with the Russian, it was only $6 billion, which mainly was only to cover the cost of carrying out airstrikes, the Russian airstrike. But Iran was more involved in supporting the Syrian regime.
And we hadn't even mentioned Russia yet.
Yes.
So you brought that in.
Yeah.
As an extra support of Assad.
Yeah. And when Trump withdrew from the agreement, he enacted a sanction against Iran, which mm-hmm. is the main financial backer of the Assad regime. And also he enacted more sanction against the Syrian regime. And even there is a newspaper owned by the president's cousin, Al-Watan, that said that the country is now suffering from the lack of oil because of the sanction on Iran. And
it's almost like an indirect sanction on the Syrian regime.
Exactly,
basically.
Exactly. Because the Iranian economy has shrunk by, as far as I remember, by 30% because of the US sanction, and now it's hit heavily by COVID-19. So it's another blow to the economy.
Another thing we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, Iranian economy. So kind of its financial support has started to wane in Syria. And so now you see like in early 2000, the like small demonstrations started breaking out in certain areas in Syria because the exchange rate was collapsing, everything has become expensive. You have bread rationing, water rationing, gas rationing, oil rationing. So the living condition has become unbearable in Syria.
It's almost, I was thinking, it's indicative, the fact that we're living through a global pandemic,
yeah,
and yet it's almost, it would seem almost silly to bring it up in this conversation,
yeah,
as it's an additional, probably minor problem,
yeah,
in Syria,
yeah,
right now.
The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
I was just reflecting on the fact as well that we've discussed, really, we've taken the Syrian civil war as a given here in our,
yeah,
discussion so far. It's like,
yeah,
it's here,
yeah,
so,
yeah,
let's just talk about,
yeah,
what's going wrong and how we can,
yeah,
like who the players are and how we can resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really discussed the origins at all. I,
yeah,
wonder if that's something that actually interests you academically, or if you're really more interested in sort of,
yeah,
resolving the terrible events that have occurred.
Yes, actually, when I worked with the Commission on State Fragility, Growth and Development, I was focusing on Syria and mainly on the root causes of the Syrian civil war.
How would you summarize them?
Oh, well.
I mean, obviously, we're doing a podcast here and it could take,
yeah, there are definitely many root causes of the Syrian civil war. You have socioeconomic reasons, you have economic reasons, you have political reasons. But the one that I kind of recall and remember from my research is that after 2000, the Syrian government adopted the open market economy or the social market economy because Al-Ba'ath Party rejected the open market economy because that would jeopardize its institution, because back in the days we were socialist or like semi-socialist country, so everything is centralized under the government.
Al-Ba'ath Party is socialist, it's,
yeah,
Sunni, is that correct?
Or just no, it's like it. In the 60s, yeah, it's secular. Mm, it kind
secular.
Of promoted itself as secular.
Because I'm aware of the term from Iraq. Was,
yes,
the
it's the same one, but there was kind of division.
I imagine there was,
yeah,
there was,
yeah,
difference.
Yeah. Mm. That is like, they kind of, this agreement happened in the 60s and 70s. So Al-Ba'ath Party, even like if you want to be find a job and take on a job in Syria, you have to be a member of Al-Ba'ath Party, or even if, like, mainly if it's a senior position. So Al-Ba'ath Party control kind of the economy in the country, and if you would have open economy, that means will, like, foreign direct investment will be offering the jobs, and Ba'ath Party will lose its position, and the government will not be able to control the economy.
Okay.
So that's why
central.
Yeah, so that's why Al-Ba'ath Party in 2015 rejected the open market economy, and they changed it into social market economy. At the same time, the country was unable. When they opened the economy, they were unable to compensate the losers, because when you open, you know, we have been kind of protecting, we were protectionist, because they were trying to promote internal industries by protecting, putting high tariffs on imports. But in light of the absence of competition, these internal companies didn't improve their kind of production, and then didn't kind of lower their cost of production. So when they opened the economy, the competitors, foreign competitors, were able to push, yeah, swoop in and push like kind of local or internal actors out of the market. But the government was not able to compensate the losers because we don't have social safety net that would expect you find it in Norway, Denmark, Scandinavian country where they have social safety net. If you lose your job, you can be trained and receive funding and they direct you to new sector where you can find a job. But in Syria, we didn't have that. So many people start losing their jobs. Also, we had droughts in the east. People start fleeing from the eastern part of Syria to the coastal area. We have the outbreak of the Arab Spring. And also the government couldn't create jobs because the economy was centralized by the government and the oil start kind of depleting, the oil fields in Syria start depleting, which is the main source of funding job creation in Syria. So the government was unable to create jobs and we had high growth rate in Syria. So that means like we have a high level of unemployment. And then all these kind of factors, combined led to the outbreak of the Syrian civil war. There's definitely many other variables. And
I was just thinking, actually, like an impression that you might get from following from rolling Western media is that it's primarily to do with ISIS sort of like moving in. So it's very refreshing actually to get a much more complex economic picture of the roots of the crisis.
ISIS, I would say it's like a secondary that it kind of swooped into the country in 2013-14. But I would say probably the condition conducive to that, to the outbreak of the Syrian civil war, started in late 1990s when like the oil fields start depleting, the government couldn't kind of create jobs, and all we probably had 210 public organization and 200 of them were kind of losing money. So even like the government has like budget deficit, they needed kind of the oil sales to fund these losses. But when they start depleting, the government kind of couldn't do anything. So like, there were many variables that led to the outbreak of the Syrian civil war. Mm-hmm. In terms of ISIS, it started in Iraq, in Camp Buka, where al-Baghdadi and all of them, they were in prison, in the same prison with members of al-Ba'ath party. So it's that is the core.
The same party we mentioned earlier.
Yes, it's in Iraq. They were imprisoned in Camp Buka. Yeah, mm-hmm. And that where the radicalization started happening in Iraq. But then when Syria has become failed state, it was easy for them to move from one country to another.
It's very good to get a clearer picture.
Yeah.
And thank you for also all these facts that you're providing to our listeners. So we've discussed the geopolitics of the Syrian civil war, the influencing countries. Mm-hmm. We've talked a bit about the origins now as well, which has been very interesting. I want to stick with the Syrian government more within the country and talking about another article you wrote, which contains a very correct prediction within it. So it was on the behavior of the Syrian government in light of of all this, like all these issues that were building pre and during civil war.
Yeah.
And you made in this article the correct prediction that the Syrian government would begin to arrest crony capitalists. And I think you mentioned the president's cousin was arrested on the date of publication of your article.
Yeah.
That's splendid timing, in a sense. So, in light of this sort of very prescient article, I want to ask you if you could give a summary, actually, firstly, of the style of the article is very economics-driven and quantitative.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you how these arguments prove so prescient, in a sense. You use this article, which you developed through your master's, and as we were talking before, like your desire to explain this economically.
Yeah.
And if you could link it somehow to sort of your predictions.
So what I like about economics is that there are models that you can use to analyze certain situations or issues happening in countries. So in the Syrian context, I think like for me personally, this article was one of the easiest because like you have the model there, like the production function, which is part of the microeconomics. It's developed by a new classical school, which is In order to produce goods, you need certain inputs, which is the capital, labor, and fuel. In Syria, the capital, you don't have any capital. All of like the internal capital left the country. They are now in Turkey, Lebanon. They're investing over there. At the same time, there is no foreign direct investment in Syria. So you don't have the capital to produce goods and services in Syria. But at the same time, Syria lost its oil field, or the Syrian government lost its oil field, and they are under the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurds, supported by the US forces. And Iran is under sanction. And recently, I think in 2019, under the lobbying from UAE and Israel and Saudi Arabia, the US Treasury imposed sanction on Iranian shipments of oil to Syria. So countries, for example, as Egypt, Morocco, and Spain would not allow oil tankers to pass to Syria. This is like you have the other kind of component of the product. You like that the other component of the production function, which is the fuel, it's not available. So when the president increased the salaries, you increase the demand. But then on the other hand, you have the supply, which is behind. It's like there is a lag. It's unable to meet the demands, which led to increase in prices. Because you have extra demand, you have more money at the hands of people, but they cannot buy anything with it, extra good and services, because the economy itself cannot produce anything.
Certainly you're talking about sort of the economic dilapidation of the country, but I can imagine creates the kind of environment where sort of the capitalistic wing of the country are gonna have a lot of complaints, let's say.
Yeah, just like you can see, like I'm once you ask me a question about economics, I suddenly like, you know, have the rush, like I need to answer. Yeah. I love, like, I'm passionate about economics. So about crony capitalists, Russia started pushing the Syrian regime to pay back the debts from like all the airstrikes, the money spent in Syria. But if you look at the Syrian central bank, they only had $400 million in reserve between gold and foreign exchange, which is extremely low, like it's nothing.
So no capital, no fuel.
No fuel, no capital, no foreign currency. And kind of, as far as I remember, the bill was around $3 billion that Putin requested from Assad to pay. And in order Assad to pay, first option is to release bonds, but no one is willing to buy Syrian bonds because the high inflation would require that the interest rate to be even higher to cover the inflation rate. So let's say if the inflation rate in Syria is 50%, the interest rate has to be, for example, 60 for someone to buy a bond to make profit from it. So, and the Syrian regime will definitely issue a bond with like 5%, 6%, or 2%. They cannot, you know, because that means the servicing the bond will be expensive. It's 60% or 70%. And at the same time, it's a risky country. No one is willing
to invest
or buy bonds from the Syrian government, because at any moment it might kind of default and not pay its bond. So this is one of the options that government can fund itself through selling bonds. The other option is taxing. And many people in Syria have lost their jobs. Most of them, they're working in the black market. And even before the Syrian civil war, the Syrian economy has been suffering from tax evasion, tax avoidance. Even like Rami Makhlouf himself, he had 60% of the Syrian economy. Many of his shell companies they were registered in Panama and in Luxembourg and other countries. So even before the war, there was tax avoidance, people not paying taxes. So like imagine during the war, the country cannot even, you know, levy taxes, more taxes, and even people, they don't even have money in the first place to kind of, you know, tax them. So there are like these kind of tools that the Syrian regime can use to fund itself. They're unavailable. So the only option, available option, is to blackmail its crony capitalists who have been benefiting from their close ties to the Syrian regime by forcing them to pay. And this is what happened with the Minister of Education, the former Minister of Education. His his assets were frozen, confiscated. Rami Makhlouf, his assets were was confiscated or frozen, and recently he was required to pay probably around $300 million. I mean, I'm not quite sure about the number, so don't quote me on the number. But he was recently in July forced to pay big amount of money under the pretext that he avoided paying certain taxes. So they started blackmailing crony capitalists.
So basically your understanding of economics allowed you to see this coming from far off.
Yeah.
You could see, hey, wait a minute, they're gonna do this.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like the models tell you the tools that the government can use to fund itself. And if they are not available, you have to find what is like that kind of, they can, the available tool, which is blackmailing the crony capitalists. This is the only available tools for the Syrian government to pay off its debts and even stabilize the exchange rate, because it was kind of, the Syrian currency was collapsing.
I just wanted to save this fourth article for last.
Yeah.
And by the way, we'll publish the names and sources of your articles.
Yeah.
When we publish the podcast, so I don't have to say them all here.
Yeah.
But we've been speaking a lot about Syria and getting all stuck into the economics and politics.
Yeah.
This article, the question that I have from this is much broader.
Yeah.
So we're going to change up a bit.
Yeah.
And so this article was on Trump's deal of the century about the Palestinian state.
Yeah.
And you made a very interesting argument within it about the relationship between economics and justice.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about economics at length. And I really liked actually the point you made in this article concerning how Trump almost misses the point of what economics needs to be.
Yeah.
So I, also as an expert in economics, but someone who's also studied human rights at length, how do you put them together? Because I think it's of immense importance for the future of the world in general, not just the Middle East.
Yeah, as I mentioned, after I started my degree at Oxford, I fall in love with philosophy and justice and political philosophy. So I wanted kind of to combine between economics and political philosophy and kind of sociology. And that is where the idea of the article kind of crossed my mind. And when we studied economics in all elementary...
By the way, this was your first article,
yes.
So I'm going through them thematically, not chronologically.
Yeah,
so we've gone back to your very first one.
Yeah. So when you kind of study elementary economic books, they focus on the rational choice theory, which is they assuming people, they are rational human beings, we make the right decision, we are like computers, like robots, we always make calculated decisions. But in reality, we are irrational. And...
Or we, shall we say, we are rational, but we also care about things very deeply.
Now, behavioral economics has been saying that we are... So, they think, rational behavior is, the ideal behavior, but we don't behave in that way. As if, you should behave in that way, but we don't. So how can we change our behavior through certain tools, policies, to behave as if we are rational.
Right, so it's we're making a mistake
by
being too irrationally caring. We have to be more calculating.
Yeah, exactly.
And that itself is a very almost bizarre philosophical claim.
Yeah, I mean...
It's been made.
I mean, to explain more what rational choice theory say, for example, if I would give you a discount on £100, let's say £5 discount on £100, you will be happy to take it. But if I would give you £5 discount on $1 million, you would not take it.
I've heard these before. Yes.
So, but it's still the same benefit. If you are rational, you should take it. You should agree. But because it's a small part of the million, you will unlikely to care about it. So that's where you behave, they would say, irrationally, because you will not care about this 5%.
So in this case, we have a very rational actor indeed, whose name is Donald Trump.
Exactly.
One of the most rational actors.
Yeah, I mean, from his background, he's immersed in finance and economics.
Absolutely.
So that is kind of expected from him, your past experience paint your kind of future behavior or kind of guide your future behavior. So that is understandable. It's not, I would say, kind of, I would not judge his behavior, but like every person has his or own past experience. So then I started reading game theory experiments, social psychology experiments, and two kind of main experiments that were kind of relevant to the deal of century, which is the trust game and ultimatum game. And in the trust game, it was interesting that in light of the absence of mechanism to monitor behavior of people, people were still behaving fairly. Like if someone would give me £100 and they are not monitoring what I'm doing with the £100, and they ask me, you can give share of it to someone like person X, people were on average more likely to give around 50%. So even there was no mechanism for them to monitor if they are giving the fair share, they were doing so because they care about justice. The other experiment was the ultimatum, and it says that if you treat me unfairly, if you, like the experimenter, would give you £100 and you give me only £10, under the rational choice theory, I should be happy because I take 10% is better than zero. But with the experiment, they found that people willing to use the ultimatum to prevent both of them, like myself and the other beneficiaries, from the money because I only receive 10% of the total amount. Because I care about justice, I need to be treated equally. So you have to treat me at least to give me, for example, 40%, 50%, or 30%. So people were acting irrationally by using the ultimatum to prevent themselves and the other person from receiving the money. And even if it happened to two other kind of random people, and you are observing the experiment, you are even willing to use the ultimatum to abort or undermine the experiment because you can see there is injustice. So people care about injustice as much as they care about financial gains, which was ignored by Trump administration. And they were thinking that if we'd offer financial gains for Palestinian, they would agree. But this is not the entire kind of case. They care about justice. There is injustice that happened in the past. It need to be addressed, and without this kind of step, Palestinian will unlikely to accept any future peace deal. And also the US under the Trump administration hasn't been playing the honest broker role. They're trying to have a peace agreement, but they're not kind of unbiased. They are siding obviously with the Israeli because there is a senior US official that kind of stated few days before the agreement that Israel has the right to annex Palestinian lands, some of them, not all of them.
It's not the most rational starting point.
Yeah, if you are trying to be an honest broker, you cannot kind of side and allow Israel to annex Palestinian territory in the West Bank. So he was, the US administration, Trump administration were siding with the Israelis. So unlikely for the Palestinian to accept this.
And we've been talking about the past, the present, and these questions are really about the future. So I wanted to ask you, in terms of Syria's future, what would, I mean, firstly, obviously, so what does the future hold for Syria in its current predicament? And what would a future Syrian democracy look like? Do you think it would differ? It's almost like, I don't know if you would phrase it this way, but Syria is almost going through a kind of revolution at the moment. Would that be a correct way of phrasing it? So it's almost like, what sort of revolution is required to achieve the Syrian democracy you envisage?
So the issue, like, if we would have democratic government, there is a big issue with the word democracy itself, because for me, back in the days, and probably for many people, democracy was only confined to elections. And that is what democracy, you go elect your representative, parliament, or presidential election. But the word democracy has more to say to it. So the word democracy has more to it than just like election. Because if you look back at the outbreak of the World War II, Hitler won and became the president through election.
He did.
And because you had weak institution in Germany, he was able to take over the entire country. So if you want to have elections, you need to have institutions able to protect the rights of minorities and people at the same time, because as John Stuart Mill would say, you have the concept of tyranny of majority. So if you have election,
and autocracy.
So like when you have the majority winning the election, you need institution to protect the rights of everyone, including the minorities.
Will this be legal institutions primarily?
Legal institutions. Mm. So you need to kind of craft kind of constitution and help reform the institution along when you introduce democracy and election in the country. Because democracy without institution is just election that would lead to a scenario probably similar to Hitler, when someone would kind of assume power through election and just, you know, start prosecuting other people. So I would say they should go hand in hand when you introduce elections and all this kind of whole aspect of democracy. You need kind of to empower the institution and help reform laws and regulation in the country.
And as a final question, we talked about Syria's future.
Yeah.
And what about your future, Iyad? And I guess the real question, I mean, we can go on about what your dreams and plans are, but how does your future intersect Syria's future? How does it? In what way do you want to provide your service?
Myself, ideally, I would like to be an economist working on developing countries. Probably I would kind of pursue my kind of current MPhil degree and then probably work for a couple of years or maybe kind of continue for doing a DPhil. But I just, at the same time, I want to combine my knowledge of economics with machine learning. So I want to see what kind of machine learning prediction can help with development, because the World Bank has recently started introducing the role of machine learning in development. So I want also to kind of include that and focus on developing countries mainly. On the side, which is kind of would be unexpected, but I'm trying to launch at the same time a career fitness, where I would start a platform to offer training for people who cannot afford having personal trainers and someone to guide them what is the right training and what is the ideal nutrition plan they need to follow in terms of in light of their current kind of economic condition, like what is the cheapest nutrition plan that would also promote physical kind of well-being and also mental well-being, because the food is also recently has been said that it's associated with mental health. So if you eat like a lot of processed food, it affects your mental health. So I was trying also to focus at the same time on this, kind of do it on the side, not kind of the main kind of goal, but it's on the side. I want to kind of promote healthy lifestyle with the cheapest means or like kind of the cheapest cost for people who cannot afford eating all the healthiest food, and just to kind of help them preserve their physical and mental well-being.
Well, Iyad, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Thank you so much.
And maybe we'll do a part two.
Yep. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.